Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the President's recent speeches on ending the war on terror and giving more transparency to the targeted killing program while reducing the use of drones. Steve Clemens, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live, joins us to discuss the significance of Obama's speech to the military and defense community and reactions to it from the reflexively hostile Republicans. Then we'll get another opinion on the Obama administration's shift away from policies inherited from the Bush administration and get an historical perspective on the changes from a former senior staffer on the National Security Council who served in both Republican and Democratic administrations. Joining us is Roger Morris, whose latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based upon thousands of previously secret documents. Then finally, with the President visiting Oklahoma today to offer aid to the victims of the recent tornadoes, we will speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter David K. Johnston, the President of Investigative Reporters and Editors, about both steps that can be taken to make children safe in their classrooms, as well as addressing America's crumbling infrastructure, since one in three American bridges are way past their design life and should be fixed immediately, with money now at the lowest interest rate in 700 years. He has an article at the Daily Beast and Newsweek, has articles at the Daily Beast and Newsweek, Pay to Fix America's Crumbling Infrastructure Now or Pay More Later, and More Tornado Shelters Not Necessarily. Joining me now is Stephen Clements, who is the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. And previously, Steve Clements served as executive director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Clements.
Good to be with you today, Ian.
And just recently, the speech by President Obama last week was referred to by the editorial board of the New York Times as a momentous turning point in post 9/11 America. How do you see the two speeches at the before the National War College and the Annapolis?
Well, I really do see it as a game-changing speech. It's very rare to see a president of the United States forfeit powers. I mean, one of my criticisms of President Obama is that he has not until now really relinquished any of the powers that the executive branch largely usurped after the attacks on 9/11. You had basically an acquiescent Congress that gave away, in my view, too much power to the executive branch. And the president is basically inviting both the judicial wing of government and Congress to come and have more oversight over some of the actions his administration is still planning to take. And that is a very rare moment. And so I think it's a step in the right direction.
So I, of course, have a lot of friends on the far left and the left in America,
right.
And I'm constantly told that Obama is as bad as Bush, and I just find that ridiculous. But I patiently listen to my friends because it seemed to me that Bush was this cocky, swaggering gunslinger who acted on his gut instincts, as he said many times, and was sort of fairly hostile and anti-intellectual in his approach. And rather than after 9/11, when the entire sympathy of the world was directed at the United States, at the very city that was attacked where the UN is, he decided to go it alone and alienate everybody and alienate the entire Muslim world, 1.2 billion people. By calling these criminals who attacked the United States jihadis, which, of course, is a term that dignified them, I can go on. But it seems to me that Bush's cocky, self-assured approach, it couldn't be more opposite to the fact that it's pretty clear that Obama has sort of anguished about these issues for some time and has come out and taken this step that you're applauding.
I think that's largely right. I do think that President Bush in his second term, particularly at the end of his second term, had less swagger than he did early in the first term and on through that. And that, you know, I often wonder, you know, if you were ever given a chance to relive history, would President Bush have given as much latitude to Vice President Cheney, have brought Cheney into his ministry? And, you know, then you can't do that. I mean, he basically left this country with staggering deficits, both in its foreign policy and national security portfolios, and, of course, on the economic front. That's what President Obama inherited. But what I found interesting in the speech that Obama gave and in talking to some senior administration officials this past week about that speech, what you see is this tension between Obama the man and his anguish over some of the decisions that he's had to take, and Obama the administration. And I think it's interesting, and it's a, you know, potentially interesting learning moment for many. Not that we should acquiesce to the idea that the president isn't responsible for everything, but I've talked to cabinet officials with him who said that the president has been wanting to, for a long time, you know, reconcile his personal views about a number of factors, you know, about rule of law, about, you know, the international system, and, you know, mutual respect internationally. There's even a kind of implicit apology to members of the media whom his administration has been beating up and spying on in that speech. Not to say that the administration is going to jump back and then basically, you know, walk away from these subpoenas of AP reporters and, you know, even a Fox News reporter on, you know, that who people who are doing their job and trying to report what was going on in government. That you see the president basically trying to set a new course for his team on everything from drones. And so I do, you know, when you live in Washington and you sit here, there's a danger that you get corrupted by, you know, being inside the game, reporting on the game and seeing, you know, positives where there are none. But in this particular case, I do think it was a very distinctive and important speech. It's one where I have been arguing that the executive branch was engaged in a gamesmanship on official secrecy that was getting worse and worse and worse and not better until this speech. And I think it was basically trying to send signals throughout his administration that they've got to change to a different course. And that's something, you know, I'm willing to applaud. And I think it's important. And I think when you look at that and compare that back with the Bush administration, it's night and day difference.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Clements, who is Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. So how much are these decisions based upon political considerations as well as personal moral considerations, given that the president is a constitutional lawyer? For example, the assumption has been that one of the reasons why he's tried to close Guantanamo, but one of the reasons why I understand he's getting a lot of advice from people in the White House saying, look, if you let these guys loose and any of them come back and launch a terrorist attack on the United States, you're toast. And similarly, I think you know, that is a consideration as well for much of what he's doing. So what's your sense of the politics behind this?
Well, I think that the president, I think that question applies to previous decisions and positions on Guantanamo more than the present, in the sense that when the president came in, he brought in a White House counsel, Greg Craig, who's one of his primary objectives was to close Guantanamo, and Greg, who you know, Truth in Advertising is a good friend of mine, basically laid out the game plan and roadmap to do so, and then was preempted by Rahm Emanuel and others in the White House, who basically argued that if the president were to proceed down that course, he wouldn't achieve any of his other objectives, that it would come back to haunt him. Now the president has won his last election. He's sitting here. He's laying out issues that I think are legacy building and legacy framing steps, and that whether or not, you know, I don't think of the 20 hardest cases that I mean, I think many people have looked at. If you let, you know, we have 20 people that you can't necessarily try because the evidence is either non-existent, but, you know, I've talked to people across the board in this, even those that are definitively against holding those captives and not putting them through our legal system, that they would likely rejoin. In this day and age, where I think it's very hard to pull off for years what Osama bin Laden did, and I don't mean to sound reckless, we'll be watching, if any of those people were to leave, we would be watching them so closely, and their lives will be short if they were to engage in activities that we thought would lead to imminent attack on Americans or allies or the United States. That's unfortunately the world that we live in. And so I think that the president is trying to make an important statement saying he doesn't believe that any of the people can't work their way through the American legal system and can't be held if they are found to be guilty in the kind of security prison circumstances that would hold them. And then he went through and he gave two interesting lessons, I thought, in the speech. One was a lesson of all the kinds of domestic terrorism that the United States has handled just fine that had nothing to do with, you know, extremist Islamic terrorism. And you know, he also went through and looked at those that had been apprehended and indicted, like Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, and others, the attempted underwear bomber. And those people are in prisons in America today and are being held just fine. No one has escaped. And so he's basically reminding Americans that a lot of the fantastic delusions that people like Rush Limbaugh and others are painting out there are just ridiculous. And I think it was, you know, important for the president to lay that out.
Well, I think of the 86 detainees that have been cleared for transfer based upon security conditions being met at wherever they're going to be sent. Apparently,
right.
56 of the 86 are from Yemen.
Right.
So that's quite a big chunk. But it seems to me that we're confusing bin Laden, who as largely, and his organization appears to have been pretty much extinguished, and this new phenomenon of freelancers and lone wolves, stray dogs, as Brian Jenkins calls them.
Right. Brian is right in that characterization.
I mean, it seems to me that if you look at the more we learn about the Sin Arabs, the more it's hard to see where the criminality ended and the ideology began. I mean, and also it's an interesting contrast that the British police, you know, shot those guys who beheaded the soldier in the legs to detain them to find more information. The FBI killed this accomplice in a murder, apparently, that the elder Sin Arab conducted some time ago against some drug-dealing friends of his. So he's not around to find out whether there's more evidence of other people involved.
I think this FBI case is very disconcerting. When I read this, I said, could you imagine? I mean, this is the kind of thing, I mean, to be candid, we always hear about the Russians doing. We have legislation in Congress that's passed because of the way in which folks, I mean, they may be human rights activists, they may be others, but nonetheless, the brutality of the Russian legal system.
The Magnitsky
and
affair,
I look
right?
at the United States, and sometimes mm-hmm. I figure, you know what, we're basically engaging in some of the similar behaviors, and mm-hmm. people ought to wake up to that. It's not only being read here, but nations around the world are engaging in the same practices, so that when we go out and try and tell them, hey, no, you need to respect human rights, and you need to follow rule of law, and they point to these cases like just the one that just happened with the FBI.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary too that the youngest Sin Arab is even alive. The SWAT team put over 200 bullets into that boat that he was hiding in.
Right.
I mean, but I think we're digressing a little here, Steve Clemens. But it seems to me that's what the so-called war on terror has sort of devolved into. The idea that there could be thousands of these disaffected people out there, both here and in the UK. Who could pull off these low grade attacks without necessarily any ideological guidance, and yet think about the idea that a couple of losers, as the uncle referred to them, could shut down a major American city for a week. Doesn't that tell us more about ourselves than the war on terror?
Well, I guess it does. And, you know, I was pleased when the president mentioned, you know, the Timothy McVeigh and, you know, implicitly in the bombing in Oklahoma. And, you know, we've had the Unabomber and we've had other kind of self-selected folks that decide to, you know, kill other people to basically, you know, for whatever reasons that they think are justified. We have white supremacists that have long been engaged in various forms of domestic terrorism. We have Cuban emigres who think that they can engage in their own kind of brand of terrorism across the channel with Cuba. I mean, you got a lot of this stuff going on and exists in the United States. And I used to work for Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico. And I wouldn't accuse people of terrorism, but, you know, near violence on occasion when we've got a lot of people in the state of New Mexico, as well as, you know, through much of the Western United States, who are so anti-United Nations or anti-international institution that they look at all of these institutions as those that impinge their sovereignty, and they feel that they've got a right to take arms against their government for doing this. There's a lot of that out there that we don't talk about in our own country. We have a lot of violence built up and pent up inside our country, and we've got to figure out how to detoxify much of that. And I think, you know, this part of the equation. But we have a system of laws and rules, and as you said, a system of criminal justice to process this. And I think that had the Boston bombers not been read Miranda rights, this would have furthered this kind of gray rule of law. Well, it's not even a rule of law, this gray law in this kind of new form of warfare that I think undermines the very essence of what American society is supposed to be about. So we should be able to process criminals and those that engage in violent activities within our system of law. And I really do think that Dick Cheney set back the country, you know, decades by basically helping to lay out a system of secret prisons, a complex of extraordinary rendition, you know, engaged in torture and the kind of behaviors and abuse that we saw in Abu Ghraib and Bagram. So all of that kind of sits like a ball and chain over the moral posture of the United States as it goes forward. And I think that what President Obama is trying to do is punctuate the end of that kind of thing. And hopefully he can, you know, but I do think it's very hard for a president to steer the ship. I happen to know that at least in the Defense Department, which has now taken over, will take over authority for drone strikes, for instance, I know that Chuck Hagel thinks deeply about these issues and is deeply concerned about America's posture and profile in the world. It's not that he will shy away from the use of force, particularly he's not going to be involved in all those decisions, but he's more of an ally of the president we heard speaking at National Defense University than some others, I think, who've been in the administration dealing with these drone issues and kind of war on terror issues.
Well, just in closing, Steve Clemens, this, of course, does not mean that the terrorism industrial complex is going away, which the foundations of which were laid by Cheney and Bush. We're still going to have to take off our shoes at airports, etc. So how much do you think that's going to change in terms of this shift in trying to end this endless war?
I think it's going to be incremental, and I think it's going to be complicated and up and down. As you mentioned in your introduction, there are a lot of Republicans who want to pounce on the president for going soft on terrorism, so to speak, and of, you know, by basically encumbering himself with oversight from either the legislative branch or judicial branch on some of the activities they've been taking. You know, they're saying, hey, you're basically giving up on the war on terror soon, because some of these guys believe in permanent war and permanent military authorization to do anything anywhere in the world that America wants to at any time. And Obama saying that he doesn't want to allow space for that track to continue. And I admire that. But I think that, you know, again, there's a difference between a president of the United States, the man, and a president of the United States who represents a big machine that has lots of pieces, not all of which it controls, because, you know, it has to get authority to spend money and authorizations and whatnot from Congress. And as you've said, the process is also a political one. So I think we're going to be at this for a while. But again, this is a pivot point, and it's pivoting, at least at this moment, in a direction that people, I think, like yourself and that I have been calling for some time.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Steve Clements.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clements, who is Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking further about the changes in the U.S. approach to the so-called War on Terror. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And the New York Times editorialized last week following the president's two speeches at the National War College in Annapolis about changing the policy away from the Bush administration to tamping down the war on terror, saying this war, like all wars, must end. That's what history advises. It's what our democracy demands. The New York Times referred to the speech as a momentous turning point in post-9/11 America. How did you see it?
Well, I think it was a classic Obama performance. I've come to think of him as the Tallulah Bankhead president. You remember what Tallulah said about a rather infamous Broadway play? There is much less here than meets the eye. This was a kind of watershed, to give him credit. He got credit, of course, simply for not being George W. Bush, which has been true of so much of what he's done or not done. I noticed the responsible conservative commentators were pleased. Someone like Andrew Sullivan thought it was Christian realism. There was hopeful candor and thoughtfulness in the president's addressing these issues, the authorization of the use of military force issue, the sort of the war without end that had not been addressed in a serious policy way. He is obviously promising here to slowly reduce the drone war. He's promising to cut back on what has been an escalating use of drones and of covert war in the Yemen. He promises outright a reduction of the use of drones in force protection in Afghanistan to coincide with the withdrawal of U.S. forces, the main body of U.S. forces at the end of 2014. That's a little noticed aspect of the speech, which I think has enormous implications for the Karzai government in Kabul, for one. Without the drones, there's going to be a rather significant shift in the balance of power. But in any case, an enormous gap, Ian, as always, between what the president says, what he articulates, the impression that he leaves, and the actual practicality of what he does. The closing of Guantanamo could happen tomorrow. Constitutional lawyers tell us this is the commander-in-chief. He, of course, shrinks from confronting his own Taliban, the Tea Party and the Republican right on this issue, but he could get those 160 76 prisoners of dubious legal standing out of Guantanamo tomorrow and close that disgrace on the American reputation. The drone issue is still there. He very poignantly said that it haunts us every day, those of us, me and my chain of command, who decide this, but of course did not discuss seriously the pressing constitutional and geopolitical questions here. Who does decide how, on what basis? He spoke vaguely of due process, but if this were an essay that Barack Obama were writing at Harvard Law and constitutional law, he would have flunked. This is not a case for continuing the drones in any legal or democratic sense. Not to mention what really struck me, and that is this whole discussion of the effectiveness. How effective is this strategy, even if you are insistent on continuing this great war on terror? The recruitment that it affords the other side, the ease with which their leadership is replaced, the fact that the terror goes on pretty much unabated, the effects of all of this, of the drone war in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, not only on our so-called enemies, but on our erstwhile allies there. He's in the process, as so often is the case with Obama, of admitting without admitting. And he even mentions Israel as a cause of the unpopularity of America in parts of the Muslim world, without really saying, of course, what could be done about that, his own power as commander-in-chief to change that equation tomorrow in terms of U.S. support for Israel, which is so crucial. And the final issue which stuck out for me was the whole issue of the security state, where we're finding new revelations every day, it seems, how intrusive this government has been, much more intrusive than the George W. Bush administration. The little scandal that's cooking here with Fox and the whole war on leakers and leaks, which I think is another sign of the wars that Obama has lost within the administration, not in Iraq or Afghanistan, but the war that he had to wage from the moment he took office against his own government. He lost that war with the Pentagon and with this huge intelligence establishment that was founded after 9/11, and the war that goes on, I think, fairly visibly now for all of us to see, that's the war of Barack Obama versus Barack Obama. I think he's genuinely torn by the moral and constitutional legal issues at hand here, but does not have the political will, the sheer intestinal fortitude, even if it's going to cost him dearly in terms of his reputation, his legacy, and it will, does not have the wherewithal to do much about that in a practical sense. So a lot of promises, very, very little in terms of concrete performance. I think we can feel better, but we're very much where we were the day before he made the speech.
And Roger Morris, it's pretty clear that the so-called threat from al-Qaeda, which has been addressed by this trillion-dollar terrorism industrial complex that failed to detect most of the people that have come at us lately, who are often described as lone wolves, stray dogs, and it's hard to see where the scenarios where criminality ended and ideology began. And it seems to me that if you look at what just happened in London with the decapitation of the soldier by erstwhile jihadis, you have this. I think it's pretty clear that this is going to continue this blowback, albeit at a low level and fairly unsophisticated. And seems to me that this whole sorry story can be laid at the doorstep of George W. Bush and his swaggering and cavalier dismissal of 1.2 billion people who he alienated the entire Muslim faith in this arbitrary way by calling it a war on terror and dignifying these people by calling them jihadis instead of criminals. Now it's pretty clear that's all that's left is criminals.
Well, I think that's all true, and I think the basic failure of the Bush administration has become, sadly, the failure as well of the Obama administration. You know, the United States, as you well know, Ian, has to be a knowing power about the world, about what it's facing, both in terms that we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also in the rest of the world. We were not a very knowing power about the Cold War, about Russia. We're not very knowing about East Asia or China, and we're certainly not knowing about the Middle East. But the other aspect of that is to know your own power structure. The Bush administration allowed this mindless, absolutely mindless, glandular growth of this enormous, largely secret, furtive bureaucracy built with $1 trillion that could have been spent, of course, openly and usefully in many other ways, and has proved to be largely irrelevant, as you just said, to the real task at hand. This was not a terribly complex challenge to begin with. We sort of knew what the history was or should have known. We knew pretty much who the enemy was or should have known, and the Bush administration bears the blame, criminal negligence, I would call it, for completely miscasting both the threat and the American response. But this president, who came to power, came to office with the opportunity to at least stop the growth of this irrelevant establishment, at least to significantly begin to reverse American policies in this respect, has been very slow, very, at the best we can say, very, very gradual in both his recognition and the implementation of policies. He has the bully pulpit. He has a capacity, and it's Barack Obama's great gift as a politician to articulate, to educate, to inform the American people about the travesty of those previous 8 years. And I think he's been, again, lacking in courage and insight to do that.
Again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. But, I mean, a lot of people have suggested that the both speeches, which were before the military intelligence audience, after all, that they were refreshing in as much as they were adult, and he was trying to engage the American public in an adult conversation about serious issues, which of course is in stark contrast to the swagger of George W. Bush throwing out all of these gunslinging cliches. So, your criticism is well taken, but it would seem at least he's trying, Obama.
Well, I think he is, and you know, this recalls that very memorable speech that he made during the 2008 campaign about race in America, about his own personal experience and history, and Obama's been very good at that. I think his collected papers and speeches are going to read very, very well indeed. What the legacy will be of his actual policies, how much he will have changed a government that really has been perverted, I think, really has been distorted by the Bush administration policies, how much he has really stopped that decay and corruption, I think is a terribly open question at very best. Of course, he articulates this as no other American politician in our memory. Bill Clinton gave a good campaign speech, but was never this candid or this thoughtful. He certainly surpasses his predecessor in avoiding all the very simplistic and cliched responses. I mean, Bush looks like a little too much like what he really was. here, almost virtually the Texas village idiot in the Oval Office, compared to someone of Obama's intellect. But, you know, in the end, it's what makes it for me so incredibly disappointing, because we do have an absolutely extraordinary president of extraordinary intellect relative to all of his predecessors and to the American political scene in general. We've never needed him more, both in domestic political terms and on the world stage. And I just think there is this fatal gap between the capacity to articulate and to think about these issues, which he obviously does, on the one hand, and the capacity to govern on the other.
Well, I think that gets to the heart of the puzzlement that a lot of people have about why he continues to be nice to the Republicans who are have transgressed from meanness to you know, obduracy of and hostility that is becoming irrational. So much of what they're doing is against America. They don't want the economy to get better because they don't want this guy to succeed. It's reached.
And he hasn't. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And he hasn't been, for example, nearly as candid about that nihilism, about that perversity on the American right, as he has been in this latest speech about terror and about the challenges in the world. I mean, I noticed Bob Dole, one of his typical remarks, saying that the GOP should be closed for repair. Well, it may well be beyond repair. No American president has faced anything like this complete nihilistic approach to government that Obama faces. And that called for extraordinary rhetoric, extraordinary articulation, for a genuine education of the American people. But I think there is, as I pointed out earlier, I think there is this also this war between the two Obamas. This is a man whose own identity crisis and whose own construction of self involved a passionate yearning to be liked, to be accepted, a commitment to, if not to passivity, at least to a kind of non-confrontational approach to politics and governance. The last thing in the world he wanted to appear was an angry black man. The last thing it seems he wants to appear now is the angry progressive liberal president besieged by an absolutely irrational and destructive right wing that even betrays the principles of the grand old Republican Party. I think this is will be the ultimate historical measure of Barack Obama. Was he not only up to articulating and understanding and grasping intellectually what he faced, but was he up to the sheer political fight, the war that has to be waged again now in American politics?
I guess just in closing, Roger Morris, there's a difference between being an angry black man and just getting tough.
Absolutely, and I think he understands that. This is obviously a guy who's very smart and who's very thoughtful, and I think in the deep dark of night understands that he's got an extraordinary historic opportunity here. But we have yet to see the kind of toughness, as you put it, the kind of resolve, the kind of candor, really, about who these people are and from whence they come. He knows that history as well. This is not some kind of odd phenomenon that just came upon us. This does have a history in the last 30 and 40 years of American politics.
Well, Roger Morris, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Councils under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about our crumbling infrastructure and the president's trip today to visit the victims of tornadoes in Oklahoma.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone. And packed her out on loan. Riders on the storm.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, who is a professor of law at Syracuse University and the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, an organization with 4,200 members. A 13-year veteran of the New York Times, he won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he has been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States. He wrote the best-selling books Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, and his latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. He has two articles at Newsweek and The Daily Beast, Pay to Fix America's Crumbling Infrastructure Now or Pay More Later, and More Tornado Shelters, Not Necessarily. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Well, Ian, thank you for having me on again.
And the president is in Oklahoma today offering aid to the victims of the hurricanes. It's, of course, a staunchly Republican state that he's visiting, and a governor who, by the way, along with the Republican legislature, has cut the education budget by 30% in the last 6 years or so. She's even called upon teachers to show up at school armed with their own weapons, which aren't paid for, and while she's cutting their budgets. So what is all of this talk about fixing, making the school safe? I mean, isn't there a larger problem here?
To say the least, you know, Utah also, I believe, has a law now that school teachers may be armed in the classroom. I certainly would not want to teach a class where any of my students are armed. Heaven only knows what kinds of things can happen when that's the case. But this is all indicative of what's happened to a society that for more than 33 years has been told continuously that the most awful thing in the world is the United States of America, that not the country, the government. You know, Ronald Reagan used to tell us that the problem is government and big government. And he loved to point to the example of the guy who, when an airplane crashed into the 14th Street Bridge in Washington, jumped into the Potomac River to rescue somebody. What he somehow failed to notice was that that guy wasn't able to complete the rescue, and it was the big government helicopters that showed up and pulled people from the water.
So given that there were seven children killed in a school classroom that had no safe room, and that only a couple of years ago, a tornado leveled a large part of Joplin, Missouri, including a local high school. What can be done, given, of course, the Republican legislature in Oklahoma's hostility to education, and because so many of them are a part of the Christian right, they actually believe in homeschooling, so they're perfectly happy to eviscerate public education. So where do we stand then in terms of the seriousness of these proposals to make children safe?
Ian, part of the problem is in how we think about and design these things. We're not going to stop tornadoes, and with climate change, we're probably going to have worse tornado problems, more 4- and 5-level tornadoes, which generally no building is going to withstand. Maybe if you rebuilt the executive office building in Washington, it will stand, but the 250-mile-an-hour wind throwing things around, including footage you can see of 18-wheelers picked up by such winds, aren't going to stop them. Here's the downside to that, and the federal government is to blame here. In Joplin, the federal government put up money to build a shelter, a safe room in the new high school. for 3,000 people. Now, the amount of warning time you get for a tornado ranges from a matter of seconds to maybe 15 to 20 minutes if you're really lucky. Can you imagine, we're not talking about someplace in New York City or the urban zones of Los Angeles where there's that 3,000 people within a block or two. People have to get in their cars and trucks, drive to this location, get out of them, run into the building. And you can see the nightmare scenario where some official decides we have to close the doors, everybody inside is going to be killed too, and you just abandon all those people outside. This is just a nutty way to do this, but the Federal Emergency Management Agency is issuing these kinds of grants to encourage that kind of building. And then secondly, in a number of states in the areas most prone to get tornadoes, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, funds state programs that are lotteries. If you build in your home a safe room, and they'll run you $5,000 to $20,000, if you build one, you may get a rebate. It's $500 in Oklahoma. It's as much as $3,500 in some other states. Now, think about that. That means only people who are wealthy enough to afford to build one will build it, and then maybe they'll get lucky and get some money back. It does nothing for people with low incomes. And it ignores entirely the research that's been done about storm-safe buildings at Texas Tech, where they take 2x4s and with a cannon fire them into these buildings to establish that they're able to withstand almost any hurricane force. That a much less expensive solution, the government's not funding that. It's funding the most expensive, least, I think, a realistic solution.
So, but the Joplin, Missouri refit for the high school that got destroyed, but it happened at 6 p.m., so fortunately there was nobody in the building. They've reinforced the entire corridor. You're arguing in your article that you need to have an L shape because, the thing could end up being a wind tunnel.
Well, and they've done that. In a lot of schools, a lot of public buildings, you walk in a door at one end and you can see straight through to the door at the other end. And in a tornado, those doors get simply ripped off, and now you have a wind tunnel and projectiles come flying down at it at whatever speed the tornado's at. If you instead put a dog leg at each end, and then you have two sets of doors, outside doors and inside doors, you can reduce the danger from projectiles that are flying. But building one for 3,000 people. I mean, the Korean Airlines is the most efficient airline I know of loading a plane. Even that airline needs 30 minutes to load a 747 that has about 300 people. The idea that in 15 minutes you'll get 3,000 people into a safe room is so absurd. And yesterday I was on the Melissa Harris-Perry show with Mayor Melody, I can't remember her last name now, but the mayor of Joplin, and she agreed. This is absolutely nuts to think you'll get 3,000 people. If you're going to build shelters, they have to be small and either right in your home, right in your school for the kids who are there, but you're not going to build a huge community shelter and actually have it work. The cost per life saved, I show in one of my Newsweek pieces, from building a shelter for everybody at public expense is between $15 and $100 million per life saved, depending on the estimates you want to make. For $15 million a life saved, awful as it is that somebody may die, there are a lot better things we could do, not the least among them, hiring more school teachers and paying them better.
Again, I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and president of the Investigative Reporters and Editors. He has an article, new articles at both Newsweek and the Daily Beast. More tornado shelters, not necessarily, and pay to fix America's crumbling infrastructure now or pay more later. Turning to the infrastructure issue that, of course, has been revived because of the I-5 disaster in Seattle, where, according to Washington State figures, there are 366 bridges just in the state of Washington alone that are structurally deficient, a third of all bridges, and more than 2,800 around the state have aged past their 50-year design lives. I take it that statistic is reflected nationwide.
Yes. The worst place in the country, surprisingly, is Washington, D.C., where roughly three-quarters of the more than 200 bridges in Washington are structurally deficient. And there are more than 200 million people a day travel over the bridges in the U.S. that they have serious problems with them. And as happened in the Skagit Valley in Washington, here you had an oversized trailer that just clipped part of this bridge built in 1955. And it was enough that as soon as the weight of two vehicles, a truck and a car, came onto that bridge, it collapsed into the river. Modern bridges are built with redundancies. So when something fails, the bridge may become unusable, but you don't have a catastrophic collapse. And imagine if that had happened at rush hour. 67,000 cars a day pass over the bridge that collapsed in Washington State. 67,000. If this had happened at just a few hours earlier, it was at 7 in the evening, but if it had been at 5 o'clock in the afternoon or 5:30, it could have been a much worse tragedy. And we've had other collapses. We've had railroad bridge collapses. We've had overpasses. We just had an overpass that was clipped by a train and collapsed in Missouri yesterday. We need to be improving and repairing our infrastructure so that it's in the kind of shape that promotes commerce and is safe.
So, David K. Johnston, in your article at the Daily Beast, Pay to Fix America's Crumbling Infrastructure Now or Pay More Later, you point out that one in three American bridges are way past their design life and should be fixed immediately. You also point out that the money that's now available for the government is at its lowest interest rate in 700 years.
Yeah, there's a Canadian organization that went through and studied interest rate records back 700 years, and we have the lowest interest rates in 700 years. So if you're going to have to do the work, then now is the time to do it. Borrow the money now to do the work. It will create jobs. Those jobs, in turn, will help to stimulate the economy. That will encourage more employment in other areas. It will mean more tax revenue. We're seeing that under President Obama, the federal government's deficit rapidly shrink. But we could be back into surpluses if we would do this sort of thing. California, you know, has gone from what looked like a devastating deficit now to a surplus. But also after making really just Dickensian budget cuts in some areas. Now, there are some politicians who are saying we can't afford to repair our infrastructure. Well, then what they're saying is we choose as your elected leaders a future in which you will be poorer and life will be more dangerous.
Well, but
why would we reelect anybody who says we want your future to be poorer and more dangerous?
Well, why do the citizens of Oklahoma, would they reelect both of their senators, Imhoff and Coben? And Coben, who's a Christian fundamentalist, said in response to the deaths of these young children with no safe room in their school, that he cares about the children because he cares more about the fact that they're going to inherit all of these debts if we don't pay the deficits. So this abstraction known as the deficits, he's more concerned about than the reality of young kids dying.
Yeah, I have to tell you that doesn't strike me as very Christian. The reality is that we have in Oklahoma a state where the leading newspaper is got an editorial bent that if you grow up there and you read that paper and you were in the, you know, all the news organizations in town draw on that paper in every city in America, the major newspapers, the major source of everything. Most of what you see on TV and hear on the radio is derived from the local paper. It has a view of the world that is essentially the view of an I got mine billionaire family, and the rest of you have to pay tribute to us. And it's good for you, by the way. The lower your wages, the better it is, because we're better off. And so why is it surprising that someone like that? I mean, turn on the radio. Last time I was in Oklahoma, most of the radio stations were ministers preaching on the air and, of course, soliciting contributions. And a fair amount of what you were hearing was just nonsense. I don't know how else to describe it.
So just in terms of the infrastructure argument, which the president is not bringing up, he did bring up these big changes, which we've been talking about earlier in the program, in terms of ending the so-called war on terror. And one of our guests who served on the National Security Council under both Johnson and Nixon said that Obama is the reason he doesn't get tough on the Republicans and push for more change facing this intractable gridlock that he's facing is because he doesn't want to appear to be an angry black man. And I said, well, why just doesn't he get tough? I mean, can he get tough and start saying, look, America, every time you drive over a bridge, you got 1 in 3 chances of the damn thing collapsing under you. Let's fix our country. Let's stop fixing potholes in Kabul and in Baghdad, and let's take care of America.
Well, first of all, you know, I hope he doesn't say 1 in 3 because the odds are nowhere near there. But he certainly could say the odds are 1 in 9. The bridge you're driving on could collapse at any time. Very, very different sort of number. President Obama's administration, I think, is revealing something very important. He's a very bright man with an extraordinary education and an incredibly felicitous writer, but he doesn't have any management experience. Lyndon Johnson was the majority leader of the Senate. In essence, he managed the Senate. It gave him management experience. We're not seeing that in President Obama. And so instead, he's acts like a legislator. He's always trying to, well, how do I get a compromise of some kind here? And secondly, I think that the president very, very much, and this is the exact opposite of what you hear from Glenn Beck, who says, you know, he doesn't want to be around white people. Almost the entire White House staff is white. He identifies with the financial class. He identifies somehow with the people on Wall Street. And the positions that he is taking reflect the interests of them. We have not had a single big league banker prosecuted in the meltdown of our economy. When Eric Holder was pressed about this, he said the Justice Department had brought over 200 cases. Well, TRAC, the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, has a database you can go through, and it turns out that they are prosecuting people. They're going after a mortgage broker in Florida and a bank officer in Missouri and other people who are absolutely inconsequential. But none of the big fish who ruined the economy have been gone after. And, you know, you've heard the phrase laughing all the way to the bank. Well, the banks are laughing.
Well, and of course now they're the House and Senate committees are rolling over to gut Dodd-Frank at the behest of the banking lobby. So,
yes. And by the way, I'm not a fan of Dodd-Frank. I think it would be much better if we went back, first of all, to Glass-Steagall.
Sure.
Glass-Steagall separated investment banking, which is a risky business, insurance, right, which is a risky business, and retail banking, where you deposit your paycheck and you can borrow money for a house or a car,
right,
or whatever.
And that's where we all lost trillions, right? Well, I'm afraid.
And we didn't. We didn't. You know, it's very important. When we had Glass-Steagall, we didn't have bank failures.
Exactly. Well, David, we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnson, a professor of law at Syracuse University and the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, an organization with 4,200 members. He's a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he's uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States. He wrote the best-selling books Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. And his latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. He has 2 new articles at Newsweek and The Daily Beast, Pay to Fix America's Crumbling Infrastructure Now or Pay More Later, and More Tornado Shelters, Not Necessarily. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was